The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, why don't we get started? My name is Dan Marcus, and I teach here at the law school. I teach constitutional law and national security law, and I'm going to moderate this panel, which is on has a wonderful title like Presidential Authority in the New Century or something like that. But it's clear that to an unprecedented extent in this new war on terror, this new kind of war that we're engaged in, the issue of presidential authority and the relative roles of Congress and the president, and to some extent the courts as well, have taken on new importance. Every president, every attorney general, every assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel tends to take a strong view of the prerogatives and powers of the president under Article 2 of the Constitution. But I think it's fair to say that the Bush administration has extended that trend to a new high or new low, depending on your perspective. Since 9/11, in most of the major actions that have been taken, the major controversial actions of the U.S. government in the war on terror, with respect to the detention, interrogation, and treatment of enemy combatants, the establishment of military commissions, and most recently, a revelation about the NSA surveillance program have involved significant issues of the authority of the president and to some extent, in some cases, significant issues about the relationship between presidential authority and legislation of Congress. We've got a terrific panel here today. And what I'm going to do is introduce all of them now. They'll each talk for about 10 minutes, and then we'll take questions from the audience. We're going to start with Lou Fisher. Lou is a specialist with the Law Library of the Library of Congress, which he recently joined for a couple of decades at least before that. Am I exaggerating?
35 years.
He was a senior specialist on separation of powers at the Congressional Research Service. He's written extensively in this field, and he's going to go first. He'll be followed by Bruce Fein, who was a Justice Department official in the Reagan administration, right? Reagan, yeah. Where he was Assistant Director of the Office of Legal Policy and Associate Deputy Attorney General. He's had experience on the Hill and is a master of the Washington think tank world, has at various times been at the American Enterprise Institute, at the Heritage Foundation, and is just to show that he's fair and balanced, also a stint with the Brookings Institution. Bruce is currently an international consultant for the Litchfield Group. Dan Levin, who's now counsel at the law firm of Wilmer, Cutler, Pickering, Hale, and Dorr, has had a number of senior government positions in the national security field in the current administration. Most recently, till a couple of months ago, I guess, he was legal advisor to the National Security Council and senior associate counsel to the president. Before that, he served for a few months as acting assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel. And a very big thing happened while he was there. He signed the second torture opinion, the one that withdrew the now famous John Yoo opinion and substituted a very different and less controversial definition of torture. It also removed from the OLC precedent some interesting aspects of the original opinion that addressed the authority of the president as commander-in-chief to act in violation of acts of Congress. Larry Halloran is deputy staff director of the House Committee on Government Reform. He's had a number of jobs in Washington on the Hill and in his home state of Connecticut. His Washington career began when he served on the staff of Representative Stuart McKinney from Connecticut. He then went back to Connecticut to practice law and served as legal counsel to Governor Lowell Weicker, who must have been an interesting client.
Every day.
Okay. Lou, why don't you start?
Stand or sit? Well, I like to stand. Well, I was happy to see at the end of 2004 OLC with this opinion on torture, supposedly changing the definition of commander-in-chief, but given the NSA issue, I don't know how much has been retracted. It looks like it's still there on the shelf, off the shelf even. I saw the lineup today. I was particularly happy to see Bruce Fein on it because Bruce and I were on the Iran-Contra Committee in 1987. I was thinking of some of the other names who were on staffers. One was Dick Leon, now a federal district judge, handled one of the Guantanamo cases. Another one, he must have been pretty young at the time, his name seems to get into the newspaper today, his name was David Addington, Vice President Cheney. Okay, I've got about 9 minutes to go through a couple hundred years. If the Bush administration wanted a good model of presidential power in foreign relations, it could do no better, and maybe it is, reading from William Blackstone, who would have put in the executive everything to do with external affairs, would have given the executive the power to declare war, to make treaties, to appoint ambassadors, to do everything in concern with external affairs, including raising armies and navies. All of that was an executive function. And when the framers looked at that model, as they did with Blackstone, they rejected entirely that model, so that the President of the United States receives nothing exclusively given to the King. Some of the things exclusively given to the King, such as the power to declare war, raise armies and navies, letters of marque and reprisal, small wars, letters of marque authorizing U.S. citizens to engage in military activities, all of that given exclusively to Congress. And what the President got was nothing exclusive on treaty making or appointments, sharing that with the Senate. So total. It reminds me, around the Iran-Contra time, I was down at law school at William & Mary starting to talk on this, and some second-year law student cut me off, and his face was really angry, red, and said to me, doesn't the Constitution give to the President the power to declare war subject to the advice and consent of the Senate? So I think that was a little indication to me about the knowledge out there. So the framers rejected the British war model. And they did it because we were creating here a small R Republican form of government, of self-government through representatives. And the reason they did it, one of the nice essays that's not read very much in the Federalist Papers is number 4 with John Jay. And he says if you look at what executives have done over the centuries in different countries, what you find are executives not getting involved in war for the national interest, far from it. They get involved in war for reasons of personal interest, family interest, interest of fame, ambition, usually always a calamity for the country. So it was that experience in mind that you would never give to the president any right to initiate war, certain defensive powers to repel sudden attacks. That understanding prevailed up to 1950 when Truman went to war on his own against Korea. And it prevails every time. I mean, the Justice Department will frequently cite the prize cases in 1863. But if you read the prize cases, you have Justice Greer saying, we are deciding and upholding the blockade by President Lincoln because it is a domestic matter. And the court said that if this were a case of taking the country from a state of peace to a state of war against another country, that's for Congress alone. And the person arguing for the executive branch, for the White House, Richard Henry Dana Jr., said the same thing in oral argument. He said, there's no question, it's a domestic matter, anything to do, going to war against another country, that's for the sovereign power of Congress alone, exclusively. So all three branches understood where the power of the war lay in Congress, except on certain defensive actions. Commander-in-Chief, I was watching Cheney on TV a couple months ago with a reporter. He says, if you look at the Constitution, Article 2, it says Commander-in-Chief. And you know, if you look at Article 2 Constitution, it says Commander-in-Chief. But what did it mean? It didn't mean the president can go to war whenever he wants to. It meant that you had unity of command, and it meant that you had civilian supremacy. The person who is Commander-in-Chief is the president, not some military figure. That understanding I've been giving you prevailed throughout, except for a lot of small things, certainly not major wars. Truman's initiative is quite extraordinary because he didn't go to Congress for Korea. He went to the Security Council. And if you read the history of the UN Charter, you'll see that one of the things that was a complication was people recalling what happened with the Treaty of Versailles, where President Wilson refused to accept some reservations by Lodge. And one of them had to do with making sure that the war power remained with Congress, and the treaty fell as a result of Wilson's refusal to accept it. So all of that was in the background in the UN Charter when it's being debated in 1945. And it got to the point where the UN Charter would say that each nation member state can give to the Security Council certain forces, troops, equipment, and so forth for military action. Was to be done in accordance with special agreements. And it's to be done in accordance with, quote, constitutional processes. So it meant that every nation had to decide for itself what the constitutional processes are. And in 1945, when the Senate's debating that, President Truman from Potsdam cables saying that I know this is a touchy matter and I want you to understand that I would never enter into special agreement with the Security Council without coming to Congress first and getting your approval. And without understanding, the Senate adopted the UN Charter. And just to nail it down, in 1945, Congress, in order to decide what the constitutional processes are under our Constitution, Congress passed the UN Participation Act. And Section 6 says as clearly as you can that whenever a president enters into a special agreement, he shall come to Congress and get prior approval. So that's the understanding. Yet, 5 years later, Truman does what he does, doesn't come to Congress. The reason is that we have never entered into a special agreement. No country ever has, and probably no country ever will. So the very procedure set up to assure congressional control was never followed, and Congress didn't do anything about it. And that was one of the first indications of what the framers set up was with the assumption that each branch would fight off encroachments, ambition would counter ambition, that kind of a model. And here's a case in 1950 where Congress didn't do it and hasn't done it very much over the next 55 years. The year 2000, I wrote a book called Congressional Abdication on War and Spending, you know, two crucial prerogatives, Congress kicking them away. You have other activities. With Vietnam, there was a statute authorizing it, but amazingly, it looked an awful lot like the Iraq resolution of 2002, where you have a president going to war on the basis of false information. And finally, although the NSA was holding on to this stuff, there's something out there called a cryptological review. It itself is classified, but eventually NSA dumped everything you could I downloaded hundreds and hundreds of pages of showing that all these signals in the Gulf of Tonkin about the second attack or about the first one. There was no second attack, which was the basis for going to war, very much like the weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist to go to war against Iraq. So we do it over and over. So the UN Security Council becomes a substitute for Congress. Constitutionally, you cannot do that. You can't have the President and the Senate on their own deciding on a new procedure that totally cuts out the House of Representatives, but we do it. We have other presidents, certainly Bush 1, going to the Security Council in November 1990. Fortunately, in that case, he decided not to go to Congress before the election, as Bush 2 did. He waited until after the election in January 1991 was a statutory action. Other cases, I always ask people, do you remember, trying to remember all the things that Clinton did militarily? And do you remember when Clinton threatened to invade a country? Anybody know the country? Who? Haiti? Exactly. A lot of people forget that. That was the threat. We're going to invade Haiti. That's a nice flavor to that. United States invading Haiti. And he went to the Security Council, and they gave him authority, countries in that region. And I was making jokes and with CRS colleagues, because the UN Security Council said that we should act in concert with nations in that region. So I said, who else is going to join us in this military activity? And I predicted the Trinidad and Tobago. And a couple of days later, I read the newspapers, Trinidad and Tobago. I mean, even if I'm trying to be ridiculous, I'm on the mark. Then I think just to complete the story, if you can't get UN Security Council support, which Clinton got for sending troops into Bosnia, but he wanted UN support for Kosovo, and he couldn't get it. And so what's the next way to avoid Congress? You go to NATO. Again, looking at the whole legislative history of mutual security pacts, never intended anything like that, enough vagueness that you could use it. But that's a remarkable procedure. The President doesn't go to Congress for authority, he goes to NATO. To go to NATO, you have to get approval of every country. So you have the United States not going to Congress, but going to what? Luxembourg and Belgium, Italy? I mean, it's an unbelievable procedure we follow, and we do it. The Senate doesn't seem to care at all about this process of having involved itself in two treaties like that, the UN Charter and NATO. What else can be said? The Commander-in-Chief is totally bloated out of all kind of context to justify anything and all, including NSA surveillance. The checks here have to come from Congress, which it's not coming from. It should come from the courts, but they've been very quiescent. The Hamdi case was not a really pretty thing, but it's a little sort of a slightly awakened Supreme Court, which I think partly, if you remember, Paul Clement from the Solicitor General's office arguing the cases for Hamdi and Padilla, they asked him, several justices asked him, what do you do with detainees? Would you torture them? He says, no, we don't torture detainees. First of all, you don't get good information that way. And secondly, it would be against treaties. We have obligations. And they asked him several times. And if you know your dates, that evening is when 60 Minutes ran Abu Ghraib. So I think some of the temper in the Hamdi case had to do with, I don't think Clement had any idea what OLC was cooking up. But there he was, he's Deputy Solicitor General, arguing the case. The other big check, and I'll stop with this, is the public. If you watch the Steele seizure case, it was Truman arguing, as today, that he has inherent power to do anything he wants to in an emergency. And when they went in the district court, the Justice Department had the wisdom to tell Judge David Pine, you can't control the president. No court can control the president. The only two checks on the president are impeachment and the ballot box. And Judge Pine didn't like that. He wrote a very spirited opinion, which carried over to the Supreme Court. And in between, reporters were asking Truman, what can you do in an emergency in addition to seizing steel mills? Can you seize newspapers? Can you seize radio stations, and he said, I can do whatever is necessary in an emergency. And the public and the newspapers, editorials and so forth, just ripped this notion of inherent power, which is not happening now, and we can talk about it later as to what's why something much more muted is happening with NSA eavesdrop. Stop. Thanks.
Bruce?
But to follow Louis Fisher is like following Shakespeare, expecting to provide a rubber performance. I want to explain what I think are the high water mark of presidential authority that Mr. Bush has claimed, to indicate that it's much more chilling than what even Mr. Fisher presented. The president and his attorney general said that inherent in Article II is the authority to gather foreign intelligence. So step one of the syllogism. Therefore, in a unitary executive, there can be no restrictions upon the president's authority in pursuing that task. Any effort by Congress to restrict the gathering of foreign intelligence, to restrain it, to regulate it, is unconstitutional. Meaning, one, not only the warrantless surveillance program by the NSA is constitutionally authorized despite the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, but equally breaking and enterings in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, opening mail in violation of the federal criminal statute, committing torture in violation of a current federal law, could even include internment camps like we saw in World War II if it's thought that interning certain citizens might induce them to provide foreign intelligence. And of course, the president has the sole say of what kind of tactic he undertakes would be helpful in gathering foreign intelligence. When the president and the attorney general have been confronted with these hypotheticals, they've not said, no, these clearly are not applicable to the current justification for the NSA's warrantless surveillance program. They've not said that. They've simply said, we haven't gone that far yet. So it's an issue we've never thought about. For 4 years after 9/11, they never contemplated any of these things, done no legal research or otherwise. But that's one element, the president's theory of once he classifies a power as executive, then it strips Congress, even under its necessary and proper clause, of any authority to try to regulate it to control abuses. Remember, the necessary and proper clause empowers Congress to address any power entrusted to the United States, whether it's entrusted under Article I, Article II, or Article III. And under FISA, after hearings disclosed decades of illegal mail openings, interceptions of international telegraphs, manipulation of the National Security Agency for criminal justice as opposed to foreign intelligence purposes, simply sought to regulate the gathering of foreign intelligence. Didn't tell the president, you can't gather foreign intelligence, just saying, in order to deter these kinds of future abuses, get a warrant. Have a FISA judge, an independent magistrate, be a buffer between the spy and the American to be spied upon. But there are other elements also that I think are somewhat chilling. The president's claimed war powers are unlike any previous claim because there is no end to the war against terrorists. The president, the attorney general have conceded. There are no benchmarks that are going to say, now is the time when our emergency powers lapse because we've crippled al-Qaeda sufficiently that the number of terrorist incidents or the risk is too low to justify emergency powers. So this is a permanent change in the political landscape, not temporary, as in all previous situations. Secondly, the president has claimed all of the world is a battlefield, where battlefield tactics that are appropriate in Kabul, Baghdad, or Kandahar are appropriate outside of Pizza Hut. Meaning that if on the battlefield in Kabul, the United States military or other personnel could shoot someone they thought was al-Qaeda, they can do the same in the United States. I testified on a panel in which a former head of the Office of Legal Counsel said the only thing restricting the president on that scare is his current executive order prohibiting assassinations. Of course, that's probably inapplicable in this situation because that executive order, and I was there in the Justice Department at the time it was issued, applies outside of a war context. It's never thought to be an assassination if you kill somebody during combat. That theory, again, has not been denied by either Alberto Gonzalez or the president. Now, there's an additional uniqueness to the president's claim, and that relates to the authority and wisdom of running a secret government. If President Bush had his way, no one in this room, no one but a handful in Congress would even know that the National Security Agency was conducting a warrantless surveillance program. It would be off of the screen, no accountability at all. Not only when Bush left, but if his successors came in, he's claiming authority equally powerful to keep it secret forever. Now, I don't know how the Founding Fathers said popular government without popular knowledge is a farce. And the kinds of information that is needed for congressional oversight is not the kind that suggests that NSA is going to tap a cable in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean at a particular longitude and latitude, but a sufficient information that a program outside of FISA is occurring so Congress then can evaluate and exercise whatever powers of oversight or legislation it has to check any abuses. Even today, the Congress of the United States does not know the full scope of the warrantless surveillance thought. Attorney General Gonzalez, certainly by indirection, has stated there are programs ongoing that have not been disclosed. They have to remain secret. The only thing that he has testified about are what has been printed in the New York Times and nothing more. That is, say, an extraordinary claim of power because it prevents any accountability by any branch. But that also extends to the president's initial claim of authority to detain illegal combatants on his say-so alone with no judicial review forever. That is, the position of the President of the United States argued in the United States courts by the United States government that if President Bush designated anyone in this audience, me, anyone on this panel, as an illegal combatant, that was the end of the matter. He could take us to the brig, the Navy ship, and we'd never see the light of day forever after until someone said the war against terrorism has concluded. Now, that reminded me of Louis XVI's Lettres de Cachet, which led to the storming of the Bastille. The remarkable thing is, which Tacit and what Louis said, is that Congress reacts with acquiescence. An invertebrate class, if you will, on matters of national security. It's simply stunning to go up there and see how unalarmed they are about any of this. Oh, it won't happen to me. Now, the echoes of the Third Reich. The administration and the Attorney General and Mr. Yu have claimed that 9/11 created a new world of clashes and conflict and strife that would justify a rethinking of our customary checks and balances. I would submit that is flatly false. Let's think about the threat to the United States posed by Al-Qaeda with World War II threats from the Third Reich and the Japanese. It's de minimis. No one worries that Al-Qaeda is going to be marching into Washington, D.C. and overthrowing the government of the United States. As savage and nauseating as their tactics are, it does not come close to threatening the security of the United States as obtained in World War II. Or even, I submit, during the Cold War. I'm sure many of you, or maybe we're dated, can remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I can recall riding down on a bicycle thinking we may be all blown up the next day if we didn't get intelligence showing where those Soviet missiles were deployed in Cuba. During those Cold War years, the Soviet Union had targeted on the United States enough nuclear weaponry to destroy every single individual. And the inability to gather foreign intelligence might be that sufficient to enable the Soviets to escape an early detection. And yet none of these extraordinary powers that President Bush has claimed were ever maintained. When the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act itself was enacted in 1978, it was still the height of the Cold War. We still had all those ICBMs pointed at the United States. And the law was passed in any event, saying, yeah, we can deal with that consistent with separation of powers, congressional oversight and involvement, consistent with a muscular presidency. So when the administration has said 9/11 changed everything in terms of the danger to the United States, in my judgment, this was pure deceit. I think it's probably wrong to even characterize our conflict and clashes with al-Qaeda and the terrorists as a war. It's not a war in the customary sense that we feel national sovereignty is in danger. The savagery of the tactics is there, but it's not the way in which the Founding Fathers or the United States ever thought of warfare for 200 years. And the reason why language is important here is because the characterization automatically then conjures up supplementary auxiliary powers to fight the particular danger. And it makes a difference whether you characterize and think about the current situation as a war, as opposed to just treating a large-scale criminal terrorist organization like you have gangs in the United States. I don't want to downplay the threat of al-Qaeda. It's certainly something that justifies, in my judgment, the extra security we encounter at airports and otherwise. But that's different than war powers. The authority to shoot anybody who claimed to be on a battlefield. The authority to detain anyone in the world as an illegal combatant and hold them forever with no end in sight. The Congress of the United States, however, in my judgment, is the chief culprit for the distortion of the separation of powers in national security areas. No matter how frequently the president may have overstepped the bounds in initiating war, whether in Kosovo, whether in Korea or otherwise, the Congress of the United States has the power of the purse. And no president, even Attorney General Gonzales, has contested the power of the Congress to say, you do that, you have no money. That's the end of it. And during the Vietnam War, when Congress thought the president might spill over the military into Cambodia and Laos, Congress did enact several amendments, as you well know, saying no monies of the United States of America can be employed to use military personnel in the Vietnam War in Cambodia and Laos. And it was accepted and complied with by President Nixon. In 1975, I believe, the Congress wanted to end covert action in Angola, simply passed the law, the Clark Amendment said, no monies of the United States shall be used to conduct covert actions in Angola. That was the end of the matter. Indeed, the whole origination of the power of the purse was calculated to check executive excesses and redress grievances. It came stemmed ultimately from the assertion of King Charles I to claim what they called ship taxes to fight wars against France and Spain in the 1630s. And ultimately, in the Bill of Rights of 1688, that claim of power ended, and the power of the purse remained solely in the Parliament of the United States. So if we really want to find the authority that has been yielded and is most to blame, in my judgment, it is Congress, because even this president says, if I have no money, I can't move forward. Thanks.
Thank you, Bruce. Dan?
Well, I guess I'm supposed to present the pro-executive power side of this. I'm happy to do that in the discussion, but I think actually now I'd rather just make a couple of points and leave it mostly for the discussion. Although I do think the comment that al-Qaeda and the struggle against al-Qaeda is not a traditional war is an interesting one. I think it's also not really a traditional crime. And I think it is an interesting series of questions as to how you ought to look at it. And it is true that the prism that you look at it through says a lot about what powers you can use to fight it. Having struggled with these issues a lot myself and working with other people on them, the main thing I come away with is I think any lawyer working in this area needs a fair amount of humility as they try to give advice, because I do think, and that's frankly true whether you're trying to predict what the Supreme Court is going to do, always a difficult task, or the more sort of lofty academic exercise of just saying what you think the right answer is. I think these aren't simple questions. And there's relatively little either judicial guidance or frankly historical guidance. I think it's being presented as a little more clear-cut on both sides than it really is. And what there is doesn't really tell you much. You know, everyone loves Youngstown's concurrence, but that's simply a method of analysis. It certainly doesn't give you any answers. Hamdi, I think an earlier speaker referred to as unclear, and it certainly is, and I'm a big O'Connor fan, although don't tell my former colleagues that, but even for O'Connor, it is less than clear what the test is. I think at the end she says, we have no reason to doubt district courts would proceed, engaging in fact-finding process that is both prudent and incremental, as opposed to, I guess, the imprudent fact-finding they normally want. And I have no idea what incremental fact-finding is, and I challenge anybody to say it. And the decision itself kind of oscillates between repeatedly referring to the narrow circumstances of this case, but then using sweeping language about fundamental and, you know, incidents of war. I think it is completely unclear what it refers to, and even if it were, it's, of course, a plurality opinion, two of whose members are no longer on the court. So I think it's the main thing I would say is I think you need to look at these issues, recognizing that they're difficult issues without clear answers. And I think on both sides, people try to portray the answers as a lot clearer than at least I found them to be. I think the other thing is this is an area where it truly is an invitation to struggle between the branches. And a couple of people have mentioned that Congress is coming up a little short. And I think that's probably a fair criticism. I think it is inevitable. It's inevitable that any president is going to do what he or she thinks is necessary to protect the country in times of crisis. You know, you can discuss it all you want, but that's what's going to happen. And I think it's inevitable that any senior executive branch lawyer is going to try to find a way to conclude that that's lawful. And the unclarity of the law is probably going to permit them to do it. There's a question about, you know, sort of what happens after that. And I think inevitably Congress and the courts will react at some point, either quickly or slowly, with more or less vigor. But I think that's how the process is going to play out. That's how it's playing out now to some degree, and it's how I think it will inevitably play out. I think there obviously are costs in this process to sort of claims of unfettered executive power, but there are also costs to imposing limits on executive power because, like it or not, the executive is the branch that can act quickly and respond to crises. I think there's been some floating of the idea, and Stuart Taylor, and I just saw this again today, but I think he's done it before, the idea that maybe there's some place for sort of executive power in the immediate aftermath of an emergency shifting over more over time to more regularized congressional activity. There may be something to that. That may be something that people ought to be exploring more. I do think the role of the executive is sort of easy and inevitable. The role of Congress is much more difficult. And as much as, you know, as pro-executive power, people like to refer to Article 1 as sort of the second preamble or the other introduction. Obviously, Congress has an important role in this, which it probably has not been playing and probably needs to. I think the role of the courts is another one that's, you know, an interesting and difficult problem. I think, personally, I think it probably should be fairly limited, but I think inevitably the courts are going to be involved and more involved as time goes on. I think the one thing that was unanimous in Hamby was rejecting any idea that sort of the courts shouldn't be getting involved in this stuff. And I think that that's probably a trend that's, you know, for better or worse, is going to continue. So I'll leave the rest for a discussion, but I do think that these are difficult questions. And I think the roles of Congress and the courts are in some ways the more difficult ones to deal with because the executive is going to do, I think, inevitably what they feel they need to do.
Thanks, Dan. Larry, you want to respond to all these allegations that Congress isn't doing its job?
Isn't done anything?
Yes. I mean, as a political department, the Congress, as has been said, isn't quite as nimble as the executive, and it takes longer to muster some action. And it speaks with 535 voices or more, and so it's more diffuse in the debate. But we have not acted as a parliament. There has been oversight. But the problem in this realm is that in for a long time, under Democrat and Republican administrations, intelligence oversight was a contradiction in terms. It just didn't happen. It was a very cozy, almost incestuous relationship between the intelligence community and the intelligence committees. And the Church Committee didn't really break that hold. It's kind of a hiatus, but and so that's become a very clubby and kind of self-policing, self-satisfied system that we're still trying to find a way to break into. The major crux of the conflict right now that we're having between the executive and legislative branches is over access to classified information. If you read the Hubs Intelligence Committee's most recent report on the authorization bill, just came out a few days ago, it's quite a schizophrenic document. On the one hand, they say we're tired of leaks, we're cracked down on leaks, we got to protect things to protect national security. On the other hand, it says, we need more whistleblowers, we need more access to information, we need more information sharing among the intelligence communities and state and local law enforcement, for example. But the executive maintains a theory of exclusive access, that they gather the information, they own it, and they only give it to who they want to give it to. And it's becoming a very serious problem, because the 9/11 Commission talked about that, the Cold War paradigm of gathering precious pearls of intelligence and not showing to anybody. It may have worked against the monolithic in a kind of bipolar world. It doesn't work now, and that gets to the discussion of what we're at war with here and what powers are needed to fight it. It's not chasing gangs, and it's not World War II, but it is something, I think, to the war side of that continuum, where sovereignty is at stake. Non-national actors can now acquire the means that only sovereign states used to be able to acquire in terms of weaponry and intelligence and information. And so some different tools are called for on the executive side, and some different types of oversight on the legislative side. So I will concede that the legislative branch has been slow on the uptake on these things, because the nature of the beast keeps changing. And so if the Congress decides we're going to rewrite FISA this way today, the next crisis would either render it obsolete or unwrite it somehow. And so we've been slow on that. But back to the use of classified information. We just had a little conflict with the Director of National Intelligence, who is, I think, in a bad piece of casting against type, has been charged in executive order to assemble and inventory what are called SBU, or sensitive and classified designations on information. We asked GAO to go look at those and find out how they're used, why they're used. It's marking is for official use only, things like that. And the Director of National Intelligence, when asked to comment on a draft report by GAO, wrote back and said, we don't have to talk to you, as you've been told. GAO has no right to look at intelligence matters. That spark is going to light a fire. That will not stand, as we say, because the entity meant to fix the intelligence community, meant to bring the reforms that the intelligence community calls for, can, on the one hand, say it's all secret when they're in charge of trying to empower information sharing. How are they going to help us share what they say nobody can see? So I predict you'll hear a lot more about. But in the broader context, I think the problem here is somewhat genetic. That there, you know, we're all, I think this whole discussion is haunted by the ghost of Boyden Gray, that the Bush I administration brought with it a strong strain of executive power and kind of reinterpretation of executive authorities. And then Bush II brought, ironically enough, brought from a governor's mansion where the governor has very little power, executive-wise speaking, brought the same kind of band of lawyers and theories with them even before 9/11. They were asserting expansion of executive authority, which the legislature was slow to rebut. So there's something more here or deeper than just post 9/11. There is a strain of interpretation that says post Watergate, the Congress took too much from the executive. We need to get it back now. And I think it's a broader historical swing than just terrorism that we need to be aware of. I think I'll stop there.
Okay. I'm going to exercise my prerogative to add a few comments and ask a couple of questions of my own. I do think there's sort of a consensus that Congress has not reacted very strongly historically, and particularly in the current period, to protect its prerogatives and to try to curb exercises of presidential power that it views as exceeding the president's powers or disturbing the constitutional balance between Congress and the president. I do think that the courts, that the Supreme Court decisions in the Hamdi and Razul cases now about 2 years ago, and the Supreme Court's reaction to the government's arguments last month in the Hamdan case show that the courts are not taking it lying down as much as Congress.
It's interesting that the administration won some issues but lost some significant issues in the Hamdi and Razul cases. The Supreme Court was unwilling to buy the sort of separation of powers argument that was aimed at it by the government in those cases, which was that the president's authority to deal with enemy combatants in the war and to decide who's an enemy combatant is something that the courts cannot stick their noses into at all. And I think it's interesting that after those decisions, I think the administration, there have been some retreats in position. And some of them are more subtle than others. But I think you don't hear the administration asserting that the courts can't review its actions in the war on terror as much as you did earlier. The second area in which there has been something of a concession to the objections to the assertion of executive power was in the December 2004 Levin opinion on torture, in which the OLC did step back from the rather stunning assertion of inherent authority in the face of congressional statutes to the contrary, passed by Congress in the exercise of its Article I powers that had been contained in the original opinion. Now, in the NSA opinion, I mean, we haven't seen the opinions in the NSA case, but we have seen something that is gives you some clues to what the legal thinking of the administration is. We've seen testimony by the Attorney General, and we've seen this 40-page white paper that the Attorney General submitted to Congress. And I think the white paper is quite instructive because while implicit in it, and maybe occasionally explicit, is this argument that, by God, if we're wrong that the authorization to use military force, the AUMF resolution, authorizes the president to do this, and so we're stuck with the fact that FISA prohibits it, then FISA is unconstitutional to the extent that it limits the president's power. But they don't say that very loudly or very clearly. And you don't hear when Gonzalez talks about this, they don't say it. And I think they don't say it as much because they've been beaten up about it quite a bit. And instead, they use it mainly as a backdrop, as an argument that, gee, maybe it's not, even if it's not so clear that the AUMF authorizes the president to do this, notwithstanding FISA, you ought to construe it generously to avoid having to deal with this inherent power question under Article II. Now, I can see that Bruce is going to...
There are a couple of things. One, with regard to torture, when the president issued a signing statement in conjunction with the McCain amendment, he clearly did not endorse what you described as the OLC opinion in 2004. The gist of the signing statement was, I won't pay any attention to this if I think it's hampering my ability to fight the war against terrorism. It isn't so explicit, but you don't write signing statements like that unless you're actually asserting that as a doctrine, because the customary purpose of a signing statement is to give a presidential interpretation of some ambiguous language, since the president is a partner in the legislative process. Secondly, whether Gonzalez, in fact, has gone further in his testimony that was presented to the Senate and the House Judiciary Committee most recently and suggests now, although initially he said we hadn't studied the issue of whether or not they could intercept domestic-to-domestic calls under his theory, he basically said, yeah, we've studied it now. We think we can do that as well. I don't find – and then lastly, in the presidential signing statement on the reauthorization of the Patriot Act, he makes these statements that it's unconstitutional to require us to even give information to congressional committees about how often we're using national security letters or otherwise. I mean, it's the most extravagant claim of plenary power to withhold any information the president wants that is, I think, has ever occurred in the history of the presidency.
Oh, I agree it's the most sweeping claim. I think, though, that there's a certain boilerplate rhetoric quality to this that it's sort of thrown in there as a reservation, but it doesn't I think you're putting a little too much
significance to it. What's interesting, and then I'll let you talk, Lou, about the court cases so far, is it's interesting that the court still is trying very hard to avoid reaching the Article II questions. Frankly, the argument that the AUMF authorized the president to detain U.S. citizens as enemy combatants in the face of this non-detention act wasn't so strong. And I think the reason the court bought it by a 5-4 vote in Hamdi was that they wanted to avoid the Article II authority questions, and I think we'll see them continuing to do that. Lou, did you want to add something on this?
I agree with Bruce. I think the administration's argument is as broad as Bruce said it is, and I think that what the current administration's position is what it was with the torture memos, notwithstanding what was said in December 2004 by OLC, and the position is that the president, as commander-in-chief in time of war, can do anything he wants to, notwithstanding any treaty or statute. I wanted to add that there is a way to exercise emergency power without trashing the Constitution, and it's called the prerogative, the lock-in prerogative. And it says that in time of emergency, where you do not have an opportunity for the legislative branch to act, to authorize a matter, the president can act in the absence of law and even against the law for the public good, not for the next election or for the midterm elections, for the public good. But then he has to come to the legislative branch to get authority. And that was the model used by Lincoln. The biggest emergency we ever had in the Civil War, Lincoln did certain things like suspending writ of habeas corpus and taking money from the Treasury, et cetera. He never claimed, as Bush does, that he's acting under legal authority. In fact, he says when he goes to Congress, he says, what my actions I thought were necessary while you're gone, and whether his language, whether strictly legal or not. So he's already giving it away, that I don't have authority. When they debated his request for retroactive authority, the debate is very clear that he did not have authority. So I think a president can act, don't pretend you have legal authority, and go to the one branch that does give legal authority, that's Congress.
Yeah, I agree the administration has not abandoned its Article II position. I just think they've been chastened a little and sobered a little, and they're a little more careful about
it.
For
the next drink.
I want to also point out that it simply is not accurate, in my judgment, to suggest that, you know, in times of crises, the president always acts to protect the people. Let's go back to World War II and the Japanese-American fiasco. The president got an affidavit from his general, John DeWitt, out on the West Coast, said, I can't find a single bit of evidence that the Japanese are disloyal, but insinuating certain elements of racism. He says, but because they've been so loyal, treason must be afoot. Otherwise, it'd make it easier for us to detain them. And that's what President Roosevelt utilized here. Even J. Edgar Hoover said, we don't need this. And when it became time to decide when the crisis after Pearl Harbor had lapsed, it was clearly timed after the 1944 elections, because Governor Earl Warren and others said, hey, we want those Japanese back in our states. Let's keep them in longer. Had nothing to do with the security of the United States. With regard to the current electronic surveillance program by the National Security Agency, when Attorney General Gonzalez was testifying for the Senate Judiciary Committee, he was asked, how come you're not intercepting domestic-to-domestic al-Qaeda calls, only those that have an international point, since that's the kind of time-sensitive, real-time interception that might thwart another 9/11? He doesn't say anything relating to the public safety. He says, well, look at how much commotion has been created by just doing what we're doing now with international calls. Think of the repercussions and how much criticism they'd get if we did domestic-to-domestic. Now, that's clearly a calculation of politics, not the public safety. And that's the whole reason why we have checks and balances, is that presidents don't always act in times of crises or otherwise for the public interest. That's the whole reason why I have ambition counteracting ambition. As Lewis said, men are not angels, and the founding fathers understood that. And we can't trust anyone in the White House to act necessarily in our interest. And one of the things to me that's most worrisome about all the things that President Bush has said is the reason why we can let this surveillance go on is, trust me, because he only got to be spying on al-Qaeda. Trust me. The founding fathers would have wept at that interpretation of separation.
Larry, by the way, if people have questions, go ahead. I do want to ask Larry one thing first, which is one of the things that I found surprising is that even among the Democrats in Congress, there isn't a major effort to do anything to legislate in response to the revelations about the NSA surveillance program. I mean, you have people, you have Senator Schumer trying to introducing a bill to give people standing to challenge the thing in court. You have Spector, not a Democrat, but you have Spector. Not regarded by, as a Democrat by the Democrats. They have Spector trying to get the FISA court to issue an advisory opinion that it wouldn't do. But why is it that do you think there's any chance that there's going to be serious consideration in the Congress of proposals to perhaps legitimate, to legalize the NSA surveillance program, but to provide some meaningful congressional oversight, or to create some new kind of system for FISA warrants for the FISA court to oversee the thing?
I do not think that will happen this year.
As
you say, the Democrats were chastened by the political reaction to 9/11, that the Republicans took all of the security portfolio and the Democrats couldn't get hold of it until recently. And so they're very skittish about making moves in that realm still. I mean, if you think about it, so the answer is no, because the situation is now so politicized and polarized that there isn't much of a middle left to talk about. I mean, when I heard about this, my first question was, Jane Harman was out there railing about this thing. She was one of the gang mates. She knew about it. She could have had amendments to FISA drafted and dropped in. That's not a security breach. She has the speech and debate clause to protect her. No classified information to propose amendments to authorize something like this because it might be necessary, and so the president powers don't get exceeded. She didn't do that. No Democrat did that. Nor did a Republican, by the way. But it could have been done. And I think the fact that it wasn't tells me it's not going to happen this year until the election, the body politics speaks again to it.
But that's a little bit unfair in this sense. The Congress of the United States, including the special inner circle, what they call a gang of 8 or 10 or whatever, they still, because I've talked to them, they still have not been told how many Americans have been targeted, what the results are of the targeting. Are they missing all the time? How do the NSA officials, the professionals who target, how do they decide? Their heart flutters? It's Thursday? The name has three syllables in it or not? We have not a ghost of an idea. Does anyone get sanctioned for spying too broadly? For being indiscriminate, all of that is unknown. And I've testified, I said, Congress, you cannot responsibly propose legislation or think about it until you know what's going on. And this is exactly what the president's saying, I'm never going to tell you this. That's what's different about Lincoln could go to the Congress because he wasn't embarrassed about saying, this is what I've done. How does the look at President Bush? He does not even go to Congress. He says, I'm not even going to tell you what I'm going to do. Not only now, but forever. And when he said earlier on, well, this has to remain secret because even the knowledge of the program will give evidence to Al-Qaeda to invade our intelligence sources and methods. What happens after the New York Times publishes? Does he shut down the program and says, this isn't any good anymore? No, it goes on right now, even though Al-Qaeda knows that this program exists, which suggests this is a spurious claim that what he's got is so secretly sensitive that to disclose anything will then alert Al-Qaeda to means of evasion.
Now, let me say something about the experiment in 1970s to set up the two intelligence committees. That was quite a calculated move that somehow each chamber was going to place its trust in a special committee that was going to operate pretty much on its own. And they're supposed to, since they're a committee of Congress, they're supposed to watch out for the interests of Congress. And I think the Gang of Eight, the way it worked, showed that they were not operating in any interest for their chamber. The Gang of Eight is supposed to be for covert operations, and covert operations are supposed to change some economic or political condition in another country. That's what a covert operation is, and the NSA surveillance wasn't that. So I think for eight people to be told this, and to be told their secrets that you cannot share with anyone, your secretary, your counsel, and so forth. I think it's an absurd situation. You cannot have Vice President Cheney telling members of Congress what they can and cannot say and what they can and cannot share. So I think they got co-opted. And I would say the same thing about the chief judge for the FISA court, the two chief judges that they had. I think they were there, as Bush says, as a judicial check on executive power. And in fact, they got co-opted. They had no business keeping it to themselves. They should have helped. Shared it with the other 10 judges on the court. So we had a situation where Pfizer was supposed to make sure that power wasn't concentrated and abused, and that's what we've ended up with.
Let me ask one follow-up question to Dan, and then I'm going to call on you. And that is, the thing that has struck me, apart from the legal and constitutional considerations, one of the most shocking things about the administration's argument on the NSA program is the fact that they went to Congress after 9/11 with the Patriot Act amendments, including amendments to FISA. And they were significant amendments to FISA, and they were billed as what we need to conduct an effective surveillance program in the war on terrorism. How can one defend, if at all, not disclosing to the Congress at the very time it's considering the Patriot Act that this huge secret program that goes far beyond FISA and doesn't involve the FISA courts is being set up at the same time?
Having had one round of interviews with the FBI on the leak investigation, I'm pretty severely constrained on what I can say about NSA program. So I won't say anything about that. I will say that generally, the Gang of Eight idea is broadly used in intelligence, on sensitive intelligence matters.
Covert operations?
Including outside covert operations. It may be that that's not appropriate, and maybe Congress shouldn't permit it. But I think it is not unusual for very sensitive matters to be shared with a small group, the Gang of Eight, some other formulation.
Shouldn't Congress have been alerted somehow, given the exclusivity provision of FISA and the fact that FISA was being amended, consideration was being given to an electronic surveillance program in the United States outside of the FISA framework?
I can't address it.
By the way, it was five times since 9/11 has FISA been amended. Five times.
Yeah.
And when the amendments came, the program was already in operation.
Yeah.
So this is what makes the whole thing a farce. If the president's theory is accurate, he didn't need any of the amendments. Why did he go up there? This whole flagellation of Congress for delaying on reauthorizing FISA? Ridiculous, because he's saying, no, you don't enact it, so what? I have inherent authority to do what I can do under FISA anyway.
Okay, your question, sir.
I'll get to the issue of what the general raised about what could have happened. If during the debate on the AUMF, this had been raised in the Congress where they said, look, we could have people super cells right here, communications could be coming into this country, we may need to listen to them, or we may need to detain citizens, and that was debated, and then Congress passed the AUMF, and the president was operating the way it's portrayed that it is. Would your debate and discussion be that Congress is just doing a bad job and you disagree on the merits, or would they still be the same legal issue and constitutional issue that you're raising at this point? In other words, if it had been discussed, and then Congress, even with the discussions, had nonetheless passed the discussion.
I think the court was wrong in the Hamdi case to suggest that somehow detention was permissible despite the 1971 Act. I think if you want to change the 1971 Non-Detention Act, you have to do it in a conscious way. It has to come up in debate, and despite the 1971 statute, we are here amending it. And the same with FISA. Despite the 1978 Act, we are here amending it. Just can't do it. No member in arguing for AUMF had any notion about the Non-Detention Act or anything to do with the FISA statute. And just add that I noticed that Attorney General Gonzalez made reference to the FISA Act, 1978. He says it's an old statute. The Constitution is pretty old. There's a lot of old stuff. And as Bruce says, it's been amended many times. It was amended even in one of the intelligence, going from 24 to 72 hours after 9/11. So we know how to amend things, and we don't do it implicitly or quietly.
And also, how could they authorize intelligence activities? They didn't even know what the scope was. I mean, in order for them to authorize something, they'd have to have an intent and vision of what the authorization was. And compare that as well with the Manhattan Project, obviously something we wanted to keep secret. The Manhattan Project was done in consultation with Congress. Obviously, they didn't disclose, you know, splitting the atom. They didn't have J. Robert Oppenheimer telling, or Enrico Fermi coming to tell them this is how you have fusion or whatever. I'm no expert in the nuclear field. But in order, but they did know they were then funding a program that was very secret in developing a weapon that could counteract the V-1, V-2 program. So you can do these things in secret. The Constitution expressly acknowledges the authority of Congress to hold secret sessions. I think the Senate was secret for the first 6 years. And there are provisions of statutes that remain classified, like the intelligence budgets. So you can do these things, fully informing Congress, and yet preventing leakage out that would alert the enemy.
I think the one interesting thing about the AUMF, I agree with what Bruce and Lou say about that. I think the Supreme Court decision in Hamdi on the statutory authority thing was very debatable. And I think the case for the statutory authority with respect to the NSA program, the relationship of AUMF and FISA is even weaker because of the comprehensiveness of the FISA statute, the strength of the exclusivity provision in it, and the fact that Congress has amended FISA several times, including in the Patriot Act. What I do think the AUMF does make difficult, though, and I'd like you to comment on this, Bruce, because you expressed this concern about the application of the war paradigm or the war model to the war on terrorism. Doesn't the AUMF, at a minimum, represent a congressional, it's not a declaration of war, but it's pretty close, and it is certainly an endorsement of the notion that this is a military war against the people responsible for 9/11, right?
Well, it doesn't declare war. It recognizes that it's authorizing the use of military force to fight terrorism and those who are complicit in 9/11. But it doesn't go on and add like it could, and we associate with this clash the following particular powers. It leaves that undecided. Exactly. It doesn't try to characterize this as a full-scale war or not. But the thing that seems to me quite clear is that Congress, in authorizing the use of military force, did not thereby implicitly repeal every single statute that the president on his say-so alone might limit his ability to defeat al-Qaeda, including statutes against burglary, robbery, murder, or otherwise. And the president takes, however, the opposite view, and that there's only one branch of government during the war against terrorism, and that's him.
But let me say that I do think the question of the statutory interpretation question is not, again, it's not an easy one. And while you might think Hamdi was wrong to hold that it essentially repealed by implication of the Anti-Detention Act, the court said it did. And so it is, I think it's clear that repeals by implication are disfavored, and I don't think you would say it repeals every statute out there that you could, you know, pick and choose that you want repealed. But it's also clear that, you know, the court, at least in one case, found that it did provide statutory authorization for something that otherwise would appear to violate.
Well, but there's a one very, very clear difference. And I was in justice at the time the 78 Act was passed. And that is FISA, unlike 4001, the Detention Act, specifically addresses what happens in wartime. It's not left to any ambiguity. And it says we're thinking about FISA during wartime. And you have, Mr. President, 15 days to go without any warrants in the aftermath of war. And then in that interim, and they debated this in the legislative history, the issue was 1 year, and said that's enough time if there's a real emergency for it to extend the 15-day period. So there was no ambiguity that FISA was intended to apply to war. And not a single member of Congress, and I've been testified, I think, four or five times, has ever said, whether they're Republican or Democrat, yeah, when I voted for the AUMF, I thought I was repealing FISA. Not one, even the President of the United States, when he issued a signing statement, didn't say, I think this overrides FISA and the mail opening provisions or anything else. So if you look at the intent of everyone involved and the specificity of FISA, it's just miles different than the Detention Act, which was at issue in Hamdi.
Yeah, you didn't want to add something.
Yeah, let me say the same thing about the 1971 Non-Detention Act, because that was enacted to override a 1951 Emergency Detention Act, when and six camps were created around the country to detain people. For some interesting legislative history, in 1971 Congress repealed the 1951 Act, and said that no U.S. citizen may be detained or imprisoned without an act of Congress. Now, without an act of Congress, it has to be an act of Congress that knows what it's doing. It can't be the kind of AUMF. But you have a situation where that was a check by Congress, just like Pfizer was, on executive power and a method of restraining. And the fact that you get a plurality in Hamdi, and it's true that Clarence Thomas threw in the fifth vote, that doesn't satisfy me at all. And there was no good briefing on it. There was no good oral argument on it. It was just something got tossed in. And just a poor decision. And we shouldn't pretend it's anything more.
Yeah. Mark?
This fascinating. And in part, because a lot of type of cases that I end up handling goes across so many different fields. You've got legal analysis, all of us as lawyers, historical, constitutional, to the extent that's the same. Influence of public opinion as to how some of these issues are discussed and debated. And lastly, it also relates to political. And I think I know the answer to the first question I got to ask, but it sets up the second one.
You're going to give us the answer?
Yeah. Why don't we just jump to the second one? Yeah. Okay.
And it's whether or not we have had, at least in our history, U.S. history, any president that has tried to push as far as at least the panel may or may not interpret he, I would say she, but I can't, to have gone in pushing executive power without checks and balances.
But also in terms of theory, President Nixon said, if I say to do it, it's legal. If I say burglarizing Dr. Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office is legal, it's legal.
And some of us worried at the time the Supreme Court decided in United States versus Nixon, the Watergate tapes case, people were worried that he might not comply with the decision. I mean, this is the guy who had done the Saturday Night Massacre.
Which is why they made it unanimous.
Exactly.
which goes to the second question, which could be anyone answering, as to what seems different now that we haven't had that similar check and balance, where this administration seems to be still willing to continue to push that envelope. The latest issue as far as whether or not Libby's lawyers were being accurate with respect to the constitutional ability of the president and vice president to declassify, certainly I think that they do have that ability, but going around what normally was the system and doing so for perceived political purposes. What's different in the relationship, and we'll keep it just with two branches, but anyone can bring in the third, Congress and the president. I think, Bruce, you had mentioned about President Lincoln, even though he was going to do this, and he felt a certain way, he had some relationship with Congress. And
he came back and got the ratification.
Clearly, that's not the case now. Is there a political aspect, partisanship, or we, this is where the history comes into, which, we can discuss about Lincoln in the Civil War time. But unless you're a distinguished scholar in history, I don't know what the politics were that were going on from a partisanship. Republicans were not Republicans as we know them today. Democrats were not Democrats. Everything was different, and we don't understand that. So what's going on today that is allowing or given the perception to this administration to keep pushing further without feeling a concern, apparently, to be checked by the other two branches?
Well, I think that there are two elements at work here. Number one, when I came to town 35 years ago and I was in the executive branch, and I think those are true of those in the legislative branch, the judicial branch, we took an oath to support the Constitution of the United States, not to support the Republican Party, the Democrat Party, or a particular individual, the Nazi Germany, you saluted their Fuhrer, but not the country. And there was a sense, and I don't want to be too utopian about this, but the sense of higher calling to comply with at least the fundamental precepts of the Constitution that would call people like Elliot Richardson to quit rather than to fire Archibald Cox. Notice no one quit during the administration of Clinton, no matter how unethical, whether you call it impeachable offense, his activity was. So people did quit, and also I think that there was less partisanship on the Hill. The impeachment committees that were established after the Irwin committee in the Senate was largely bipartisan. William Cohen at that time was a Republican who was a very staunch critic of President Nixon. And the impeachment was not viewed as a partisan matter, as happened in Clinton. And if you go up on the Hill at present, almost every issue is viewed by Democrats and Republicans as a wedge issue. Will this help or hurt the party? They don't say, is it good for the country? Is this just so fundamental that we have to put aside partisanship and return to statesmanship? No one like Henry Clay who says, I'd rather be right than be president. And that just makes it very, very difficult to get them concerned if they don't feel it's hurting the party. The second element is, in my judgment, the members up there are totally unschooled in what we're talking about here. You cannot refer to the Federalist Papers, the history of India. I don't think they actually realize how much their power is being usurped. I remember there's one question the senator Specter, I said, well, Mr. Fine, what do you care how much information we have as the Congress? He said, I'm a citizen of the United States. I don't want to live under a monarchy. And this is sort of stunning. To have that, he's sitting in the Senate. His powers are usurped. He sort of shrugged his shoulders. And when the question had arisen as to whether or not they could get John Ashcroft and his deputy to come and testify as to what legal advice had been given to the president right after 9/11 as to the authority for the NSA surveillance program, Senator Specter was almost begging, like Henry IV at Canossa, to let Attorney General Gonzales to permit them to testify. He said, no, sorry, this classified information, executive privilege, you can't hear any of this. Instead of what you would have gotten maybe in the 1960s or 70s, fine. We'll enact a law that says the department has no, they have no money for the next year unless these people testify. Just use the power of the purse. And with regard also to the partisanship, I remember in the 60s, even when the Democrats were in control of both houses, you had Lyndon Johnson in the presidency, you still had some oversight, you still had Fulbright committee kind of hearings, where it was critical of their own party. Now, no matter what happens in Iraq, no matter how absurd the claims are that we're just on the edge of a democratic flowering, there's nothing.
I have an answer, though. What's different? Answer your question. What's different? I'll introduce a whole new subject here, but what's different in the relationship to the executive legislative branch than certainly 1860 is television. The media mediates, dominates the debate, shapes the debate, forms, and the Republican Party learned the hard way against Clinton and the government shutdown that a branch that speaks with one voice wins the argument. And so they're very gun-shy about these high-profile debates toe-to-toe against the executive branch because you lose it. You lose it on TV. And I think that explains some of the partisanship and some of the ignorance level in both branches, the legislative branch, because if you make your living in 30-second, 10-second sound bites, the Federalist Papers don't come out much.
There's a debate recently that if one party controls both houses of Congress and the White House, you're not going to get any oversight. But Bruce and I remember very much what the Carter years were like. And he had one cabinet official after another threatened with contempt. You either get us the documents or you're going to go to jail. And they coughed up the documents. So that model doesn't work. There are a couple of other things, Mark, that have brought us to this point. And it's not just the last couple of years. The political science and law fields have been pumping up presidential power for a long time, decade after decade. And in political science, for instance, Richard Neustadt, you read his great book on presidential power, there's not a hint of any legal structure or constitutional structure in his book. President, the more power he can get, the better the country's off. That's the argument. I'll tell you one other thing. That's a long, deep. Everyone is being trained and taught that way.
That's the legacy of the New Deal period.
That's right. And the last thing I wanted to mention is the media consistently miseducates the public. I'll just give you one pathetic story involving me with my efforts to have some influence. I was watching the New York Times in 1995 on the Bosnia situation, and the reporter, front page stories above the fold, kept saying that President Clinton doesn't need authority from Congress to send 20,000 troops to Bosnia. So I wrote to her, I said, why are you saying that? I mean, I think he does need authority from Congress. I mean, you're not an expert. Why are you saying something like this? Why don't you say, as a reporter, what's true, that President Clinton claims he doesn't need authority from, or the White House argues he doesn't. Why don't you say that? So a couple of days later, I get the New York Times, and there it is, page one, above the fold, the reporter saying President Clinton claims he doesn't need authority from Congress. So a couple days after that, I read the newspaper on the Hill called The Hill, and they'd oppose him sending troops to Bosnia. But now in an editorial, they say he doesn't need authority from Congress. So I called him and said, why did you say that? They said it was in the New York Times. So that's the level of intelligence we have.
I think the other thing I think, Mark, that I would say is different, and earlier I was trying to argue that the administration has pulled back somewhat from the extreme position they took in the torture memo. At least tactically, they pulled back in some situations. But I do think, and this will sound a little inconsistent with this, what's different between this administration and earlier administrations is these guys are really stubborn. They, what most presidents would have done in this situation with the NSA program, if they had done it without congressional authority and because they thought it should remain secret, and then if the secret came out, they would have put a proposal before Congress. There's no question that I think the smart thing for the administration to do would have been to come up with a legislative proposal to ratify where Congress would approve this damn program and set up some kind of oversight mechanism that the administration could live with. And I think they could get that from Congress, and they would be much better off then. Now, I know, you know, Larry will say, they'll say two things. One, well, you know, it's dangerous to start the legislative process. You never know what will come out. But the other thing is these guys just don't want to concede that that it's appropriate to do that.
No, I agree. The stubbornness factor bordering on arrogance is definitely, you know, flavors the relationship. But let me at this point, though, a personal plug to say that it is, I think, too easy to say and wrong that this, you know, the Republican Congress simply done no oversight of the Bush administration. I mean, I have to resent that. I do oversight for a living. We did 19 hearings on terrorism before 9/11. Nobody showed up. The media wasn't there. But we did them. And I was told to do, you know, perform impossible anatomical acts on myself by the Bush administration many times. I got a lot of knives in my back for the price of asking and getting some things from them. So
is your chairman typical?
No, and that's our job. I mean, that's under the rules that the Republicans wrote for the House. That's our job, is to oversight, and we do it.
Yeah.
And so it's not that the oversight that Henry Waxman would do. It's not for John Dingell, but it's, if you look at the hearing records, it's there, and the questions are being asked, the documents are being tanked. It's just not on TV.
Yeah.
I think history shows the intelligence community follows the directions of the White House. They're not rogue elephants out there. And the National Security Agency is doing what they're doing because President Bush ordered them to do it. This is, you know, this isn't a multi-headed executive branch. The Bush administration is very clear and directive.
The unitary executive.
What is to be said and what is not to be said. You know, this is unitary executive taken to an extreme. So I don't think that there's any diffusion of culpability.
Yes, Lynn?
Three things that would concern me, which goes, I think, much deeper than anything that Truman would have had in mind with his inherent power theory. I'll just name three, and you can probably add to it. I mean, first of all, would be what is happening to experts, the fellow at NASA and other institutions, where you have some 24-year-old telling him what he can and cannot say, who's already fabricated his education, the 24-year-old. He's not in government anymore. But that's one thing against experts. Anyone who says something that's inconvenient to the White House gets targeted. And the agency might pull back, but agencies don't always pull back for very long. I think Mark knows better than anyone how much staying power agencies have to hurt somebody. The other second area, very interesting, the White House leaks information about Valerie Plame. Gee, I think we'll go get the people who leak the information. No, you go get reporters. That's another big chill across the country. Any reporter who messes around, you can get go after them. It's quite a third one. If a woman is a defense attorney for a terrorist, go after her. I don't pretend to know all the facts there, but that certainly sends a message to any defense attorney who wants to take someone who's sort of a nuisance to the White House. So those are three elements. I bet all of you can figure out other ones that show how blanket wide it is to maximize presidential power at the cost of the whole society.
We've reached the witching hour. I want to thank all the panel members, and I think Mr. McClanahan has some closing blessings.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming. This event has taken a lot of work. Mark Zaid did most of the phone calling and basic harassment to get our esteemed speakers here. And I want to thank him for all the help that he put into this and the James Madison Project. Y'all don't want to hear from me. So what I'm going to say is a couple of administrative remarks and then let you all go home. Number one, if you need a receipt for any of your registration materials, you can see me afterwards and we will get one to you. Number two, by virtue of signing up for this conference, unless you ask us otherwise explicitly, we will add you to our list for being informed of future conferences and release of books, proceedings, and stuff like that. So if you don't want to be on that list, you can just send us an email or just come up and say, you know, I don't want to be on the list, and we won't put you on it. That being said, I want to thank all the panelists who are here today and all of you who paid us money to come attend this. This will help us pay our bills quite well. With that, have a good night, and I will talk to you later. This is-